Hey everyone, it's Jackson back with another episode of the Sunstone Podcast. In this episode, I had a conversation with Brittany Hartley, who recently wrote a book on Mormon philosophy. I really thought our conversation was fascinating and hope you enjoy it. Before we get to it, I just wanted to remind you that if you want to support the work that we do here at Sunstone, you can always visit our website and make a donation of whatever amount you feel is appropriate. We wouldn't be able to produce the content we do without helpful listeners like yourself. Thank you so much for your continued support, and I hope you enjoy the episode.
This desert prize opened my eyes and says we need more water here. What is it you believe in, my dear? Where is it you call home? And when the darkness comes, tell me, what is your sunstone?
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Sunstone Podcast. I'm here today with Brittany Hartley, and today we're going to be talking about her book, Mormon Philosophy Simplified, An Easy Latter-day Saint Approach to Classic Philosophical Questions. Wow. I just want to start, Brittany, by saying how much I enjoyed reading your book, and I thought the title was very apt. I found that this was the most accessible text that I've read as far as Mormon philosophy is concerned, and so I would definitely recommend it to anyone that is looking to have kind of a soft introduction into what can be a complicated, I don't know, there's a lot of different texts out there and a lot of different voices, even within our young tradition. And so I was just very impressed with the way that you were able to kind of bring those all together into consistent, schools of thought and just really accessible summaries. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Jackson. That's high praise coming from you, and I appreciate it.
I do want to know, though, what compelled you to write a book on Mormon philosophy? I mean, a lot of times, just in terms of philosophy itself, a few people besides Latter-day Saints might combine those terms together. And I get the sense that when Latter-day Saints think of philosophy, it's not always on the nicest of terms, right? There seems to be this suspicion there. And, you know, it's often combined within the phrase, the philosophies of men mingled with scripture, right? Mm-hmm. And so it almost seems to, you know, carry some negative baggage within our tradition. So, what compelled you to write your book? And as far as notions of philosophy within the Mormon tradition, how might your book help us, reframe our thoughts regarding it?
Sure. So writing is just really how I process things. I just, whenever I want to learn something or I'm thinking about something, I'm writing. So that's kind of my natural process anyway. Mm-hmm. And more than anything, it's just the book that I needed when I was 17 or 25. And I really wanted to understand what Mormonism existentially was so that then I could kind of navigate my own relationship with it. Mm. And unfortunately, there's just this huge gap between, you know, because our theology is so enmeshed with our history, it takes a decade, for me at least, it took a decade of solid historical study to kind of coax out the best of Mormon theology, the best of Mormon thought. And so I as I'm writing, and it's really just for me, and by the end of it, I looked and I said, you know what, there's a space here where no book exists, where it's either, you know, The Work and the Glory, or I don't know, these kind of books that you get at Deseret Book, or it's these 600 page books about philosophy and Mormon history, and there's not a lot in between. Mm-hmm. And so I just really thought, you know, at the end of kind of this journey, that I wanted to leave my book behind as a kind of shortcut bridge for anyone who wants to think deeply about their faith, but may not have the tools or desire to go all the way down the rabbit hole of church history. I'm a history teacher by trade, mm-hmm. so I had some historical training to be able to do that. So I just really wanted to leave it behind in this kind of bridge space, because I think we can all benefit by thinking a little bit more deeply about the answers that really govern how we live our lives. Mm-hmm. And so when it comes to Mormonism and kind of the response, it is really unfortunate that, you know, the only time we use the word philosophy is the term philosophies of men mingled with scripture. But there's nothing inherent in philosophy that is an affront to Mormonism. In the book, I include many quotes from prophets, apostles, thinkers about how the glory of God is intelligence and how learning is supposed to really be central to our lives. And philosophy is this great treasure trove of the world's best wisdom. So if we can just have a little humility, a little bit of fearlessness, we can kind of look at philosophy and say, you know, maybe there's something here. Maybe there's some tools here that might help this process of learning and thinking about these really deep existential questions that we already have to answer just in life. And by thinking about it and being a little bit more self-aware of how we're answering those questions, we can, as Socrates says, live and examine life, where we do what we do for a reason. And I think that philosophy is a great tool for that.
Hmm. You give this quote that I hadn't actually encountered before in your book, and I loved coming across it in order to perhaps counter some of the negative ideas about what philosophy is in Mormonism. It's from Brigham Young, and he says that this people have embraced the philosophy of eternal lives, and in view of this, we should cease to be children and become philosophers, understanding our own existence, its purpose, and intimate design. Then our days will not become a blank through ignorance, but every day will bring with it its useful and profitable employment. And besides, there's other quotes similar to that in which philosophy or theology, which your book engaged pretty deeply on, I think, you know, they're cast as positive things that are necessary for us as Latter-day Saints to fully engage our faith and to fully engage the world around us. So I enjoyed coming across that quote in particular.
Yeah, that's a fun one. It's not something we think a lot about. If the prophet today were to stand up and said, we should all be philosophers, I think mm-hmm. would be very confused. But in early Mormon, this idea of gathering truth and seeking truth, and that we should all be thinking a little bit more deeply about, you know, why we do what we do, and is it a reflection of our own belief system? We find that especially in Joseph Smith, mm-hmm. but even continued with Brigham Young, who was not as much of a theologian, but still saw the value in philosophy, to the point that, you know, he made sure that there were theology classes in the Brigham Academy that became mm-hmm. BYU. And so we do have a history of Mormon thought. Mm-hmm. We just kind of have forgotten it, you know, correlation, and then just kind of forgotten our own history a little bit. And so to dig some of that up was really meaningful for me.
Hmm. Yeah. And you mentioned kind of your own personal upbringing, and I failed to ask that at the beginning of the interview because I was so anxious to just dive right in. But could you give us just a little bit more information about maybe where you were raised, or how you came to be involved in history and philosophy? And I understand that you've been a release time seminary teacher as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was raised in the church, raised LDS. By the time I was a teenager, maybe 14, 15, it was really, I mean, every lesson kind of in youth Sunday school at the time was strength of youth pamphlet based. And so I kind of thought that Mormonism was these rules that to me didn't have a lot of theological depth to them. I really couldn't wrap my head around them. I really bristled at mm-hmm. the idea that this was all that our religion was. So by the time I was 16, I was not active. Mm-hmm. I had actually been removed from my home, and I was living at my uncle's house. And I just, you know, by then I still knew I wanted to be a history teacher. I wanted to know, I wanted to understand, what is the purpose of life and meaning of life, and what does it mean to be human and the human experience? And I was just reading incessantly, and I came across just some really light at first Christian philosophy, maybe some C.S. Lewis, and then kind of came across some Pratt brothers and some of the early Mormon thinkers. And I was completely floored, because I thought, oh my gosh, like, I've been raised in this religion, thought it was surface level nothing that I couldn't even couldn't even get behind. And here's this strand of Mormon thought that is answering some of the problems in traditional Christianity that had some depth to it. And I was just completely floored. And so I was just reading incessantly. I ended up going to BYU Idaho and studying history and philosophy there, which was really fun for me. And it was really a saving grace for that little 16-year-old girl who just couldn't, I needed more than the For Strength of Youth pamphlet at the time.
Yeah,
and I needed to know that this religion was more than just like, don't get tattoos. I just couldn't do that. I was already mm-hmm. thinking about these questions. Ended up going through a faith transition maybe in 2010, where it just became a lot more nuanced than maybe I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. But even after that, was still able to teach seminary. And sometimes I approach things a little bit more symbolic or nuanced mm-hmm. than some of my fellow seminary teachers, but the kids seemed to respond to that okay, and I enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. And so, thinking about my faith has really always been central to my life as a Mormon. Mm.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And, you know, it hearing your story, there's just so much that I can personally relate to there as well in terms of my background and my teenage experience. I too went through a phase of reading and research that just really turned Mormonism from something that I did or something that I participated in, right? Through, you know, different practices or like you mentioned, things that I wasn't doing, right? Mm-hmm. And it suddenly became a very viable option, you know, for my life to become a worldview that I actively wanted to claim and incorporate. And it was through reading these different thinkers and coming across Joseph Smith's own really expansive thought in many areas. It was a great experience, and you know, my faith hasn't been the same since. But you mentioned that you know you kind of went through maybe a faith transition, and I don't want to call it a faith crisis or anything. But as far as your book is concerned, you know, there's individuals out there that I think could very much profit from reading it and getting you know, somewhat of a basic framework about philosophy and about the intersections of Mormonism and philosophy. So do you have any thoughts about how your book might help individuals who might find themselves in, you know, experiencing a crisis of faith, specifically from a Mormon perspective?
Yeah. So there's two thoughts that come to mind when I'm thinking about either faith transitions or full-on faith crisis. One of the things is that people often feel stifled in Mormonism, right? Like they or their beliefs don't fit kind of the cultural box that we've created. And I think this is especially true for women. There's a very clear box given to women pretty early on, and it's still the number one reason why women leave the church is because they feel there's no place for them. There's no one in the religion that looks like them or acts like them. So studying just how vast Mormonism is, how many threads of theology, how many times the apostles themselves differ when it comes to even some of these foundational beliefs, the different paths of various Mormon thinkers, the heroes in our own community who move the conversation forward. I mean, Sunstone is great about this. It shows the full color spectrum of Mormonism. Right. And it can really help people see that just because you're not Peter Priesthood or Molly Mormon who went to BYU and had four kids or whatever, doesn't mean that there's no place for you. So Mormonism doctrinally, not culturally, but doctrinally really gives you so much firepower in the idea that you have your own path and you have your own journey and you have your own relationship with God. And that's something that's the start of it, right? Mm-hmm. A boy had his own relationship with God outside of hierarchy, outside of a system. Mm-hmm. So people who are seeking validation in that way, who maybe are feeling like their path is going in a different way than maybe the culture will recognize, can really find in our history and our own mess of beliefs that there's room. There's more room to this inn than first meets the eye. Mm-hmm. And so I've had many people who get into Mormon history and say, there's a lot more room here. There's a lot more colors here than I experience in my local ward. And that can give you a lot of just personal validation and strength that where you feel like you should be going or wherever God is leading you, that you can just keep plugging along and not worry about if it's fitting the box that we've kind of created. Mm. So the second thing is for people who end up leaving the faith for completely valid reasons, can oftentimes find themselves a little lost, especially for the first few years. Some even experience a kind of existential depression, even nihilism, where you go from the system in Mormonism where we like to say we have an answer to everything. And then all of a sudden you've kind of lost your foundation and you don't have any kind of compass for how you want to live your life. And philosophy is all about how do we cultivate the good life? In what ways do human beings flourish? What are the best ideas that we have? So studying Mormon philosophy, and what I really tried to do in this book is say, here's the question, here's the foundational question. Here's some historical framework and some terms around this question. Here's Mormonism's answer or answers. Mm-hmm. And then what do you think? Yeah. And so what it does is it becomes a place, kind of a table of reconstruction. So it allows people to take some of the things that they liked about them, about Mormonism with them, with a little bit more peace, hopefully. And it also helps you to unravel maybe the things that you don't believe anymore and reconstruct like a new ethical system, for example, and do it on purpose instead of kind of haphazardly as you're trying to recalibrate yourself maybe after a faith transition. So I really hope that this book exists in this bridge space for a long time for people who are thinking about their faith, but also for people who are leaving the faith, because you're still going to have to answer the questions about what is the meaning and purpose of your life? What is what right and wrong? And how do you know? You're still going to have to answer those questions.
Right.
And so it can be really helpful. Philosophy and Mormon philosophy can kind of be a table for you to work with those things wherever you are in your faith journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's great. And I completely agree that, you know, there's still going to be questions on the table, right? Mm-hmm. And I often see just in terms of the people in my life, and I think statistically as well, in terms of maybe the more online disaffected members or people who leave the church within an American or even a Western context, you know, very, very often it might be the case that due to their lived experience within the religion, you know, something that they might consider to be a very like high demand religion that they took part in with fundamentalist tendencies, even at times, that they might revert to a kind of staunch logical positivism, right? A kind of like materialism, or like you said, a nihilism. And so I appreciate your book, not just for showing that there's other options within the Mormon tradition, right? That there's these various voices, but just in general that, you know, there's certain questions that need to be answered for any of us to make sense of the world around us, right? So I think you provided a great framework, not just for understanding how those ideas exist within the Mormon tradition, but also just, you know, great introductions for how they might exist within the larger Christian tradition or within Greek thought. So I appreciated that.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Anson Park, Executive Director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. I want to invite you to our weekly Sunstone Firesides. Do you remember those? Firesides that they used to have dating all the way back to the 1930s, when the LDS Church would hold monthly meetings to discuss really important gospel topics. Those meetings became known endearingly as Firesides. In January of 2019, Sunstone launched a new podcast that incorporates a nod to these Firesides. Featuring a weekly evening podcast, it will display a range of hosts, all women, as they chat with diverse guests from across the Mormon spectrum. The hosts are all female-identifying that represent a broad perspective in Mormonism. These podcasts will be released every Thursday evening, so you can have that fireside feel brought right into your living room. So grab a cup of cocoa or coffee, since at Sunstone there is more than one way to Mormon. Snuggle up under a blanket and listen to incredible interviews by and from incredible people. You can support women and their work in Mormon studies, which is desperately needed, by donating at sunstone.org or becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to sunstone.org and click on the podcast tab for more info. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
You mentioned earlier that your book allows readers to begin to understand some of the key differences between, you know, Christian thought and Mormon thought on different subjects. As you did your research and as you've done your reading over the years, are there some areas where you found Mormonism to be the most, to be especially distinct from, you know, perhaps classical theism or the larger Christian tradition?
Yeah, there's a real sweet spot here that it's really one of the most overlooked aspects of Mormonism. And we see this in the conversations. There's conversations between Robert Millett and Richard Mao that really reveal some of the ways that Christianity has become more Mormon, even because of the problems of classic theism. So Mormon philosophy would argue that the Mormon God is a limited God. And rather than that be a weakness, that's actually a huge strength when we're talking about some of these philosophical problems, like the problem of evil. So God is limited by the nature of free will of self-existent and self-determining creatures down to the very atom.
Right.
The Mormon God is a co-creating God, co-creating the earth with all life every second. So this gives us a better entry point to be able to talk about the problem of evil, especially. So God is not the ultimate creator of existence, nor the creator of us. Mm-hmm. God is a God relationally. So we see this in Christianity 100 years after Joseph Smith, in relational theology, or the idea that God is not static in perfection. We mm-hmm. see that in process theology. Mm-hmm. And these are recent movements within Christianity. I have a friend here in Boise named Thomas Ord. He's a major Christian theologian.
Yeah, he's very nice. I really enjoy his work.
Lovely man. I coached soccer for his girls, and so we were able to become friends, and we do some Mormon Nazarene things mm-hmm. here. And he wrote a book called God Can't, where it talks yeah. about a limited God who, you know, can't show up when people are being tortured, for example.
Right.
And this is a theological place where Mormonism shines, because this is somewhat new for Christianity, but mm-hmm. it was always that way for us, where right, God yeah. is not implicated in all the evil on earth, because he didn't create the rules of the universe. He's part of a self-existent universe. A coexistent universe. So when I go to Sunday school, I cringe when I hear things like, you know, God is in control of my life, or God saved this person from a flood, but let the other ones die. We really don't have in our theology that kind of God that is in control of all things. That language right. kind of taken in from Christianity mm-hmm. and to our own demise, because it gets too problematic when you are talking about evil. And when you're talking about suffering, to have that kind of controlling God, the mm-hmm. bigger you make God, the more powerful yeah. you make God, the
yeah,
bigger.
Yeah, agency, especially. Yeah, huge problem with agency there.
So some of our intercessory prayers kind of make it sound like we believe in a God who is in control of all things. And I just do not find this in our theology. Mm. It's much more theologically sound to say that God is working within the framework and choices that we create, and that he's already there, already co-creating with us, and that it really makes us God's hands in the universe, which I find that very empowering and action-oriented, which I think is really great, instead of maybe just waiting for God to fix it or praying to God to fix it. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to the problem of evil, I think we have this huge advantage. One of the disadvantages when you have a material God is that something that I see that happens over and over, is that it sometimes becomes too easy to put on our own projections onto God.
Right,
so instead
yeah.
of having the advantage, there's always pros and cons with any.
Right, for sure.
Right. So what we get in advantage, we do have a disadvantage in that God, it makes God a little bit less mysterious or ethereal, because sometimes we end up with a literal white man with a white beard sitting on a literal throne,
right? Yeah.
A multitude of heavenly mothers as a kind of dynasty. And this is our theological tradition. And I would argue that even President Oakes and President Nelson have spoken in ways that make me think that they believe in eternal polygamy. Mm. And as a Mormon woman, this is deeply troubling to me. And I would rather have a little bit more mystery in the idea of God and the nature of eternal relationships than to exclude women and exclude the LGBT community, or in the past, people of color.
Right.
To have a material God means that we are often dragging God into political debates in ways that sometimes embarrasses us later down the road. So that is the disadvantage of having a material God, is you lose a little bit of mystery, and then it becomes very political, very literal in ways that aren't always good for everyone in Zion.
Yeah, I totally agree. And from my own experience, and certainly in engaging the historical sources, it seems like Mormonism obviously has gone through different developments in its history, where either, you know, it might be in a period of retrenchment or assimilation with the larger, you know, American society. Mm. And with that, it's always interesting to see how we might try to identify ourselves. Self-identity is a really interesting concept, I think. Because there's been times in Mormonism where we've been so, you know, we've been very dead set on defining ourselves against, you know, maybe the American public or against Protestantism, right? Different forms of Christianity. You know, then we go through phases as well, which I think we have in the last couple decades, where, you know, instead of perhaps emphasizing our unique Mormon qualities as much, we find it to be more conducive to either missionary work or relating to those around us to, you know, really try to emphasize our similarities by saying, you know, we're Christians just like you. And sometimes I think that's come at the expense of of downplaying some of these really unique doctrines of ours, such as, you know, eternal progression, the finitude of God, God existing within time. You could go on and on, I think. Do you have any ideas or thoughts regarding, it's something I like to call the Protestantization of Mormonism, right? Do you have any ideas about why that might be an issue or what we gain or lose in doing so?
Yeah, I think we lose more than we gain. And yeah. You're absolutely right that it happens historically because we were persecuted and we decided that if Mormonism is going to survive, we're going to have to assimilate into the broader context. And so by doing so, yeah, by saying that, you know, oh, we have a Godhead just like you, well, you know, yes and no. And then
right. And
we can never really fully claim Heavenly Mother because that just doesn't sound Christian enough. And
right. That,
you know, can sometimes be to our detriment. So I understand in times past where we had to assimilate. I would just in today's times really look at the times when we're playing that kind of persecution card and just say that, you know what, we can maybe set that card down. We're doing okay. Mm-hmm. We got enough in the bank, as right. We now know. And so we don't really need, I think now, to do that in order to survive. In fact, in order to survive, one of the things that we maybe could do is resurrect some of these early ideas that were so exciting and so revolutionary and so
right. Empowering
that we've lost in correlation. We have people leaving because they don't find any depth in Mormonism. They don't find the freedom in Mormonism that used to be there. And so I think, although maybe it had to happen in certain times or correlation had to happen, that doesn't mean that moving forward, that needs to be kind of our go-to card to play. We can start maybe, and the internet is part of this. And I hope this book is part of this and these discussions are part of this, mm-hmm. of resurrecting these ideas that made Mormonism so exciting in those early days. And so, interesting
right. That
we don't talk about in Sunday school anymore. And so there's a lot of room to grow here and there's a lot of work to do. And it's conversations like this that I hope make it so that it will start seeping into the conversation at large.
Yeah. And I honestly think that Mormonism has some unique tools in its toolbox in order to survive and even potentially thrive in the modern era in a increasingly secular world. I think we have aspects of our theology which certainly give us an edge to encounter the outside world and to engage it in ways that are robust and profound and enriching. Mm. One of the things that come to mind, you know, when I spoke earlier about some individuals leaving and perhaps taking on, you know, a kind of staunch materialism, right? Mormonism posits a very profound theology of matter, which, you know, differs quite a bit from our Christian brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. And that I think that coupled with some of these expansive notions of truth seeking that we have ample sources for within Mormonism's early history about going out into the world and, you know, collecting truth, you know, no matter the source. I think that uniquely equips us to engage science as a means of a faith building process and, you know, tackle these larger questions without, you know, exercising concern that, you know, it'll lead to a loss of faith. Because I think as well, by simplifying, our Mormon philosophy, you know, we've lost out on, quite a bit that we could have capitalized on.
With science, especially, we have so much potential to really, more so than I would say in traditional Christianity, because the problem with traditional Christianity is you have things going in and out of existence.
Right.
And it's just, there's just no room for that scientifically and at least, you know, what we can see and experience. So the fact that Mormonism has things that exist have always existed.
Right.
And things that don't exist. That gives us some room materially to be able to work with science in ways that hopefully are very positive. Unfortunately, by the time evolution was making its headway, we had kind of already lost some of that. I mean, the Pratt brothers, they were trying desperately with whatever scientific tools they could to match their theology with the science of the day. Now,
right. Some
of that theology ended up not working out because the science has changed.
Right, right.
But the attitude was that whatever we do, it needs to match the realities of the world that we know from science. Mm-hmm. And then by the time evolution works, you know, rolls around, we had already kind of lost that. And we had, mm-hmm. We fought against it in ways that theologically we really didn't need to.
Right.
Real shame. Right.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Whenever religion fights against science, it's a fight that we're not going to win, you know, mm-hmm. over time, it's a fight that you're going to lose. So there's no need to kind of put up this wall against science theologically, and we have a lot of room for that. But I do want to go back to this idea that you brought up of a retrenchment period, and that's really my fear for Mormonism right now, is that because there are people leaving, there's I sense this on Sunday when I went to Sunday school, and because people are leaving, there's this threat, right? We're faced with a threat again. Whenever Mormonism goes through a threat, we circle the wagons,
right.
The identity markers go up, the obedience narrative goes up, the follow mm-hmm. the prophet narrative goes up, because we're really trying to crack down because we feel threatened. Mm-hmm. And so my fear for Mormonism for this time is that if all the people who are becoming a little bit more symbolic or nuanced or thinking about things or rediscovering this early Mormonism, if they're met with rejection by the community because we're kind of in a retrenchment mode and they end up leaving or being excommunicated or whatever, then we're going to have this schism where all that's left of Mormonism 50 years from now is kind of that most fundamental strand where we really will lose our Mormon philosophy roots. And that's mm-hmm. my greatest fear. Yeah. And so we have an opportunity, as we're kind of in a church-wide faith crisis, to dig into these tools that you've talked about of early Mormonism, and use these tools to mature as a people a little bit and to reclaim some of more early Mormonism that was more helpful than maybe the way the culture is talking about it today. And so we have an opportunity to do that, but there's an equal opportunity that we will just circle the wagons and double down and push out anybody who's maybe saying a different narrative, until all that's left is, you know, the people who are out, who maybe had a wider view of what Mormonism was, and then the people who are in, who are just obedience-based and are missing the fullness of Mormonism. So I see both as a potential, and that's my fear for where we are right now in Mormonism.
It's probably happened to everyone. You're sitting in Sunday school and suddenly you think, wait a minute, I've heard this all before, about 100 times. I'm ready for something new. Well, I'm happy to report that your dream Sunday school class is just a click away at the Sunstone Magazine podcast. Here, you get to hear the best Sunstone articles in an audible quality package. You'll hear about everything, from the first vision to feminism, from LGBT issues to scriptural interpretation, from polygamy to poetry, from scholarship to mysticism, from personal essay to fiction. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone. Come join the Sunday school class you wish you had.
As far as what I've seen in my own life, There's interesting dynamics at play within religions, if we're approaching it from a religious studies angle, where, you know, perhaps more high demand or even conservative fundamentalist religions tend to retain members better than their liberal counterparts. So, you know, it's certainly a double-edged sword, but I think in terms of having a theology which can still be, you know, still retain its kind of demand upon our lives, right? To be something that's immersive. I think our faith is very unique in that sense, where it operates as more than just a set of beliefs that we assent to. It's also a lifestyle. It's also a culture. You know, people have argued that it's an ethno-religious identity in some cases, right? So we have a lot of things going for us that I think put us in a very unique position compared to some other denominations, right? So I think certainly there's ways that we can capitalize on our early Mormon history and kind of this heritage that we have of Mormon thought that is rigorous, that's engaging, the science and the scholarly work of the day. And, you know, I'm reminded of Richard Bushman's term, radiant Mormonism, right? I think there's ways that we can certainly cultivate that and make that our emphasis rather than going into a mode of singular retrenchment, where, you know, we are I mean, in some ways it's instinctual within the faith. We have, you know, kind of deep-seated fears about survival. I think it's safe to say that, you know, our days in Missouri are long past us, right? So yeah, we certainly don't need to feel called to respond in the same way to the outside world.
You're right, though, that, you know, Mormonism does community extraordinarily well, right? I mean, other religions look to us as far as, I mean, even Thomas Ord, he's just shocked at the idea that wherever I live, I just go to wherever ward I'm assigned to, right?
Yeah, you just show up.
The notion of that is still just like shocking to him, you
right.
know, that we all just, this is our community and we show up. And when Mormonism does community, we do it well. And the question we're left with now is just, if we're in a retrenchment period, which I think we are, how big do the community borders go? Mm-hmm. And so it's my fear that there are times, you know, September 6th and all that, there are times that when we're in a retrenchment period, we can sometimes, those community borders don't extend to Mormon thinkers. Mm-hmm. Don't extend to Mormon thought, because it can be seen as a little bit more periphery or a little bit more fringy.
Right.
And we intellectuals will sometimes find themselves on the other side of that community order in a way that does disservice to everyone. It does disservice to the church, and it does disservice to those who find themselves outside of the community that they love. And so it's my hope that we can find that balance where, yes, we do community well, but can we extend our community to include those are who are preserving Mormon thought and maybe challenging some things that we
they're pushing the boundaries, right? They might not fall within the bounds of orthodoxy as far as the institutional church is concerned.
They push the culture sometimes. That's what they do, but that's a service that they provide. Can we push the boundaries out far enough to include them? You know, as well as other groups that find themselves on the fringe. So I hope that we're able to, for our own survival, but also because we lose something every time that we say, you know, the border doesn't extend to you. Mm-hmm. You know, we lose someone in Zion, and it does us all a disservice.
Right. And I think of, I believe it was Hubie Brown saying, you know, that we don't care, you know, if your thoughts be orthodox, right? So much as you have thoughts, right? That was a rough paraphrase, but I would love to see a Mormonism that espouses that. I do think it's important to have, you know, common beliefs that unite us, right? I think that those should perhaps be considered a bit broader than, you know, if you support this or that policy, which recently came from Salt Lake, you know. Mm-hmm. I would love to see further room, intentional room made in the pews for people of different kinds of thought, because I think at the end of the day, we're healthier with it. You know, we're healthier with that kind of conversation happening within our faith.
Yeah. And if we do get to the point where we kind of lose Mormon thought for whatever reason, as part of our culture at all, you know, where we're not this internet age, we have the opportunity to reintegrate some of these things. And some of that is already happening. Right. Mm-hmm. But if we don't, then that is the greatest fear, that all that will be left is just the fundamentalist strand of Mormonism, which is not the fullness of what Mormonism is and the beauty of what Mormonism is and could be.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't have a systematic theology within Mormonism, right? And there's plenty of in-house disputes about what constitutes official doctrine. That's probably one of the most Mormon things you could argue about. You know, I think certainly, you know, we don't have professional theologians like other faiths might, in the sense that, you know, they go to a divinity program sponsored by our faith and, you know, eventually go on to be, you know, full-time clergy or scholars or whatnot. We certainly have Mormons engaging in theology, Latter-day Saints engaging in theology. But we risk losing out on a lot if we push further ahead and only allow the space of theology to be engaged in by those who occupy the highest positions of institutional leadership within the church.
I hope Mormon thought survives. I mean, you're right. We have our intellectual wings, but they're not the same as a divinity school. And so a lot of times we have, for good and bad, we have the BYU professors and certainly CES kind of filling in these holes.
Right.
And we can sometimes find doctrines that become part of our culture. And when we do the history of who said this, where did this come from? And we'll find that, you know, there's a hole there and some seminary teacher said this and it kind of caught on or whatever. And so sometimes for these holes in theology where we're trying to figure things out, you know, our intellectual wings will fill that space. And I just hope people continue to engage in Mormonism so that there is that balance between hierarchy and authority, and also, you know, the scholarship and the thought and the intellectuals. It's always been, since the very beginning, since the Pratts and Brigham Young, it's been a relationship of tension, but it's a relationship that they need to keep that relationship as tension-y and as awkward. And sometimes, you know, they battle it out or whatever.
Right.
We still need that relationship. And I mean, very early on, Brigham Young would push back, you know, Orson Pratt, and they'd fight about the nature of things. And there's been times where one side will fight back or whatever, but that's a relationship that we just have to have if we're going to stay relevant, you know, in a modern scientific area. We need our thinkers.
Just one final question before we go. I want to know if you have a favorite Mormon philosopher or thinker, you know, who might be who's been the most influential for you in developing your own personal Mormon philosophical views. If you have one or multiple, I'd love to hear them.
Oh, I'm going to have to do multiple because
I would do the same.
So I think originally I just really, there's a reason that someone like Terrell Givens, who knows the goods, the bads, and the uglies of Mormon history, still says to this day, I've had an intellectual conversion to the ideas of Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he's a brilliant guy, and there's a reason for that. And so for people who leave the church, I just, and it's completely valid to do so. And spiritual journey does not end when you do so. But there's a reason that someone like Terrell Givens, who knows all the bad things about church history, says that he had an intellectual conversion to some of the ideas, because some of those ideas were incredibly profound and ahead of his time that Christianity wouldn't do for another 100, 200 years.
Right. Yeah.
So at the beginning, just really the ideas of Joseph Smith and the Pratt brothers, Hugh B. Brown that you mentioned is a favorite of mine. In modern times, like many Mormons, I was drawn to Soren Kierkegaard, who's an existentialist. He's a favorite of David Paulson, who is a modern Mormon philosopher, teacher at BYU. Let's see. I do want to highlight, maybe I'll end here, my hero.
Okay.
My kind of hero in this space, in this modern space. My hero would be Lester Bush, who was the man who wrote the most influential piece of scholarship to influence the Brethren to drop the priesthood ban.
Right.
You know, from Spencer W. Kimball's journals that it was really the piece that stuck with him and challenged his ways of thinking and his biases.
Yeah, he marked it up with his classic red pencil.
Right. And it did something. It did something inside where he was starting to look at his own ways of thinking and where he maybe could be wrong. And it opened him up to be able to receive the revelation for the removal of the priesthood ban.
Right.
And Lester Bush, you know, he was vilified for this article, right? Mm. He was pushed to the outside of our culture because he was saying something that was against what the current doctrine was. And you find this over and over in philosophy. So the classic would be Socrates. He's teaching the youth, and he's maybe challenging some of the myths of, you know, the Greek gods. And he ends up, you know, drinking hemlock for corrupting the youth in Athens. And so I just love, I'm so just taken by this idea of philosophers and scholars who speak truth to power. To speak honestly, to speak thoughtfully, and not always in a confrontational way, but to, you know, look at text and look at what we're doing in our behavior and really think about it, really sit with it, really study it, and say things that maybe even will be challenging to the culture of their day. And in the end, many of them, philosophers and prophets together, you know, the general tone is that the culture will crucify them for it. They will reject them for it, and they'll do it anyway. And that kind of moral courage is to me just the greatest amount of personal integrity and moral courage. And I truly believe even some of the ones who were, you know, excommunicated long ago or whatever, that they will be vindicated because they did the right thing and that God was doing a work through them. We can see now that God was doing a work through Lester Bush, through Spencer W. in order to bring this about, and more and thought and scholarship was very much a part of that process. And so some of the ones who maybe are a little bit more,
they push the boundaries, right?
Yeah, they push the boundaries, and they may be, what is the word that I'm looking for?
Maybe like faithful dissenters or...
Whatever you want, yeah. Whatever you want to call it. I can't find the word. My brain is not working, but...
Oh, no, you're good.
But, yeah, I just find so much courage in that journey and the work of God that these thinkers do, even when their community rejects them for it. And I think the more that we listen and integrate some of these voices, even the ones who maybe found themselves on the outside, the stronger that we'll be for it, because a lot of times history proves them right.
The prophets in the margins, so to speak, in the wilderness.
Yes, in the wilderness. And it's not just prophets. I really believe that it's philosophers too. Philosophers are not accepted by, you know, the cultures that they're raised in the same way that prophets aren't. And there's just so many heroes in this space, in this Mormon intellectual space then and today, who are just bringing so much beauty and truth, and speaking from this kind of wilderness. And I just really have found, many people have found God and Jesus in the margins, in the trenches. And I've found that in this journey of studying Mormon thought, I found God in those places as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Brittany. I'll be the one to say that, you know, I felt like your words and your testimony even were very powerful there. And you're obviously very sincere and articulate and well-read. And, you know, I'd love to have you on again in the future to discuss more questions of, you know, we can perhaps dive into the particulars of more different parts of Mormon philosophy. But I just want to thank you for coming on the show today. And I want to encourage the readers that if you know someone or if you are interested in the kind of discussion that you heard today, to be sure to check out Brittany's book, Mormon Philosophy Simplified. It will definitely be worth your time, or certainly, you know, if you feel like it might be a good primer to, you know, give to your own teenagers, right, who might be going experiencing something like Brittany or like myself once did. And this is a very valuable resource. And so, Brittany, I think you succeeded in providing that for individuals who are in that kind of space.
I appreciate it, Jackson. It's been a pleasure. I hope we get to talk again soon.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Who is it that you dream of, my love? Who is it you'll become? And when the storm clouds come, tell me, what is your sunstone? Sunstone.